This week on Last Impressions, episode number 11, well, you'll find out what I'm talking about as I do, because I'm just making it up. Probably something about immigration, some drug dealing going on, attacks on Christians, and letters to the editor, and maybe some other stuff. I'm Justin Katz. So nothing special on the intro there. That's just a 12-bar blues in E-flat minor for those keeping score. At the end of this whole thing, at the end of the podcast, I'll try to see if I can make that into the song. The idea is that this week has been just kind of nuts for me. Nothing in particular, you know, Tiverton's budget committee cycle. The budget committee is done with its job, more or less. So this week was kind of catch-up, and I started the week. I mean, we're on Thursday, so it's not over yet, but I started the week all raring to go, and I had a couple days where I felt like I was getting a lot of stuff off my to-do list. Taxes paid was a big one, all that kind of stuff. And yesterday it was just like a wall, suddenly nothing, just running through molasses kind of thing. And so I haven't had a whole, I'm behind on my reading and all that kind of weekly activity. And so, you know, I'm just, this week I don't have all the clips. I'm just got a couple topics I might want to hit on. Other than that, well, we'll just see. So I figured I'd open with just an improvisation, you know, and if it all works, great. One thing I did want to bring up, I wrote about this on OceanStateCurrent.com. Columnist Tony Magliano, his column runs regularly in the Rhode Island Catholic newspaper, and he had an op-ed about, it's an immigrant or migrant immersion experience where probably what it is, some activists will bring out people, either just people willing to pay for the experience or journalists to promote a particular point of view, and they'll have them do some of the same activities as people trying to get into the United States illegally, just so they have that experience and they can go describe it in detail to their readers and change public opinion. And it seems to me to have an important lesson for Rhode Islanders in general, but also almost a spiritual, theological lesson. So here are a couple of clips. This isn't necessarily paragraphs as they're written. I'm picking from a couple places in his column. But Magliano writes, "On a 4,000-foot steep desert mountaintop, we paused to try to determine where the overgrown trail continued. As I looked out in all directions, I could easily imagine many of the dangers facing me if I was a migrant. Running out of water, heat stroke, hypothermia, rattlesnakes, thorny cacti, a debilitating fall, disorientation, and getting lost. Well over 2,500 migrants have died trying to walk far around the wall and through the unforgiving Arizona Sonoran Desert since its construction." Now, what strikes me here is people are making this dangerous journey. You know, it's not as if they're going about their day and suddenly they discover that we put a desert in their way. This is a deliberate thing people undertake, knowing the risks, and parents grab their children to bring them with them on this dangerous journey. And of course, we should have sympathy for those folks, and especially the ones who really have no choice in it, like for the children who are brought along. But what I wrote about and what really concerns me here is we have this tendency to, objectify the people for whom we have sympathy. So we picture the typical, picture in your mind the illegal immigrant family, you know, however that image appears to you in your imagination. And that's what we focus on, and we picture their plight, and they're there as an object for our charity. We've created this image in our minds, so now we can do something that makes us feel good about ourselves to help them. And we always have to try to do some of that for empathetic reasons and for charitable reasons. But I think it's too easy to lose sight of the fact that they're people who make decisions and have responsibilities too. And when you think of the horrors of where they live, whether it's political oppression, drug dealers overrunning the roads, just a terrible economy and things falling apart. That if that's what's driving them to make this hard journey, this terrible, dangerous journey with children and what have you, then to some extent, we have an obligation to try to help them fix that back home, not just to create a welcoming environment to them, to draw them into the desert, so to speak. But they have a responsibility, too, to stay or somehow work to fix what's home, not just to escape. Now, we can sympathize and understand people fleeing an area where things are difficult, but in the same way that we have a moral obligation to help them, they have a moral obligation to help the other people who can't leave and to help change things where they are. Now, that can sound harsh, and especially sitting in a, you know, relatively comfortable existence in Rhode Island, USA, but that's the reality of it. And when we're making moral judgments, we can't just beat people up over this objectified image of a charity case. We need to think of those people and as people with their own moral agency. The one, I guess, somewhat humorous parallel somebody commented on I forget where, either on OceanStateCurrent.com or Facebook or something, to my post on this, and said, well, you know, it's a lot like Rhode Islanders. And that's one of the arguments I've made when people ask, well, why have you stayed? I say it's kind of like missionary work. If I leave, if you leave, assuming you're still here, you make it that much harder for the next person to stay and to fight. You make it that much easier for everything to fall apart. So I think we, even in Rhode Island, there's a parallel where we do have a moral responsibility to stay and to try to fix things. Locally here in Tiverton, periodically I'll come across somebody commenting somewhere how happy they'd be if I were to leave town. Well, you know, I'm not going anywhere for that reason, because you want me gone, and I think I'm trying to make things better here. We have that obligation. Now, obviously, that doesn't mean nobody can ever leave anywhere. That's not good. We have other moral obligations to family, our own children, ourselves. And we have vocations, and we have to figure out for ourselves what we're supposed to be doing in our lives. So I'm not saying that nobody can ever go anywhere. We have to stay and fix it wherever we are, whatever it takes. But as with everything, this is obviously founded in my own Catholic Christian views. And as with everything in Christianity, the question ultimately is, why are you doing it? And if you've taken this grand assessment, if you're sitting in oppressed village in South America, and you've taken in the totality of your circumstances and given all of the often conflicting and contradictory moral pulls on you, you've concluded that, you know what, we've got to make this dangerous trip across the border and escape this life, then, you know, that who am I, you know, to say that that's not correct? Or if you're just taking a better job in another state and leaving Rhode Island, then, you know, hey, that's what you do when you get there is another thing. If you go there and try to fix that place, or if you cross the border into the United States and try to somehow do stuff to fix your homeland, then, you know, that's part of you're fulfilling your responsibility that way. So these questions become very individual and very complicated over time. But I'm just talking, I guess, about people who just, they give up and they say, you know what, this is too much work. I don't want to deal with this in my life. I'm going somewhere where people actually agree with me and do things in an intelligent way, you know, Carolina or something like that. You know, that's, I mean, bully for you to get a better life for yourself. But you know, we have to put some weight, I think, on fixing things and having responsibility when you show up. I mean, I was raised to believe that when you enter any location or organization or scene, leave it better than it was when you found it. So there are a lot of reasons to leave Rhode Island or leave Mexico. orders of magnitude of difference there, but there are a lot of reasons to leave. But you have to be careful, and your intentions do matter. And it occurred to me actually this morning while I was kind of rolling this around in my head, that it's a little counterintuitive for that statement to be coming from a conservative, because it's usually the left, you know, progressives, liberals, whatever you want to call them, who are intention-driven, where we want to help poor people. And so we're going to set up this system of welfare. And yeah, maybe some people will be dragged into dependency. Maybe it will create disincentive for good behaviors like getting married and staying with your children and having a solid family. Maybe it'll create those unintended outcomes. But we're doing it for the right reasons. I've had arguments in policy all across the board, from welfare to even stuff like campaign finance, where I say, hey, look, if you make it harder for people to run for public office, fewer are going to do it. You're just helping the corruption. It was on disclosing donors. If you're forcing people to disclose their donors, you're opening those donors up to attacks from activists on the other side, which will suppress donations and also creates this hostile political environment. And the response is, oh, that's not the intention at all. You know, that's not why I want to do this. Well, why you want to do this is important. Intentions are important, but they're not the only thing. I mean, the gauge of is how obvious it is. So you want to say, let's stick with the campaign finance one because it's relatively unemotional and therefore not all that tricky. So you want to get corruption out of government. So you come up with this idea, why don't we disclose donors? But then that looks like, oh, hey, this is becoming a disincentive to donate. This is becoming a tool for the worst activists, I find them mostly on the left, to abuse the system in order to persecute people and suppress votes and speech. Then you have to reevaluate and you say, you know what? I intend a good thing here. I'm getting a bad thing. The consequences have to be part of your equation along with intention and the obviousness of the outcomes. I was listening to this morning to Hoover Institution podcast, The Classicist. I didn't catch the host's name, but Victor Davis Hanson's a well-known classicist and conservative pundit. We're talking about World War I, and Hanson was saying that U.S. President Woodrow Wilson didn't understand human nature. And so he did a lot of things at the end of World War I, trying to resolve things and get things back on a good footing, that really set the stage for World War II. Now, you could say things like talking about self-determination for nations, and Wilson being progressive was already on this idea of identity politics. And so he kind of queued up Hitler with his German master race talk. And also to look to countries that had large German ethnic populations to say they should be part of our nation, they should be an independent voice, and ultimately lead to World War II. And now you can defend Wilson just like you can defend, I don't know, Obama, and say, well, the intention was good. He just did it poorly. But to some extent, these things, I mean, you can't just excuse. Let's simplify and say he's to blame for World War II. He's not. But you can't excuse World War II because you had good intentions, right? Your effectiveness has to be part of it. I think we need to humanize people so they have their own agency. And then part of that, it comes back to the same thing. Part of that is if you're thinking of people as people, you'll be less likely to set up incentive structures that make them lead them to bad decisions, like crossing a desert with their children where 2,500 of them have died, or paying drug dealers to smuggle them into the country and they end up as sex slaves or whatever. I mean, that's created, I think, in part because we have this tendency to take their humanity away from them and see them as children or pets or cartoons or charity cases. When if we're thinking, how do I get this person And, you know, it's Holy Week, so I'll be a little more overtly religious than usual. How do I save the? How do I save this person's soul, or more properly, how do I get this person to save his or her own soul? You'll come up with better solutions, and you'll avoid, I think, unintended consequences. On a similar note, just today, there's news that they've busted a big drug ring, illegal drugs in Rhode Island. And naturally, all the people running it are illegal immigrants who've been deported and come back. Now, there's a real danger in that kind of assessment, that you'll blame illegal immigrants everywhere for this small group and what they've done. And that would be unfair. But at the same time, it kind of has to. And if you're in a state that's declared it, or a city or a state that's declared itself a sanctuary, and then welcoming, and we want all people, and we're going to give in-state tuition to illegal immigrants, and maybe next up our driver's licenses. That state is going to be a lot more attractive as your headquarters for your illegal drug ring, selling deadly drugs with fentanyl and all that, than some state where getting a traffic ticket could have you deported again. Locked up, looked at closely, where you send your kids to school and their immigration status might draw attention to you. If you're doing bad things, that's not a place you want to be. So we have this constant struggle trying to find that balance of being welcoming and being empathetic and having human sympathy for people, and setting up the environment for bad decisions. On that note, another thing I saw this morning that seems related, Mark Stein writing on his own website about some of the Islamic radical terrorism in the world. He talks about suicide bombs hitting churches all over the place on Palm Sunday and surrounding days. And he writes, so I'll read a paragraph here. He writes, "As I said, not a small thing, but it doesn't seem to make a lot of news. Other Christian leaders, from Pope Francis and the Archbishop of Canterbury on down, seem to have more to say about potential hypothetical upticks in, quote, Islamophobia, than about the sustained attempt to eradicate the oldest adherents of their own faith. Western politicians don't seem to have much say about it either, perhaps out of shame. On America's watch, public expression of Christianity was obliterated in Iraq, and the last Christian church in Afghanistan razed to the ground. Almost exactly 2 years ago, when 148 students were slaughtered at a school in Kenya, President Obama could not bring himself to identify them as Christian, even though their killers had gone to great pains to separate their captives according to their faith, releasing the Muslims and killing the Christians. As I remarked somewhat mordantly, apparently, black lives don't matter when they're Christian." That's Mark Stein writing on Mark Stein Online, his website. What jumps out there is on America's watch in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, it's almost like you're better off, at least during the Obama era, you were better off not having the United States on your side. This is Glenn Reynolds, who primary blogger, used to be the only blogger, now the primary blogger of Instapundit.com. He frequently writes with respect to Islamic radicalism and terrorism. Be careful the incentive structure you create. If you're creating an incentive structure where cutting off a few people's heads gets your religion or your social group or your culture or whatever deference, then you're going to get more of that behavior. That's just how it's going to work, and you need to take that into account as you're coming up with figuring out how you're going to set up your society. Something similar this week, much smaller, insignificant for the most part. Episode: a woman from Tiverton wrote a letter to the editor, was published in at least two of the local papers, alluding to the Center for Freedom and Prosperity, for which I work, some vague connections between us, or indirect connections between us and the infamous Koch brothers, and wound up asserting that I'm essentially being funded by the Koch brothers to use Tiverton as an experimental playground, you know, which is on its face ridiculous. But I kind of pushed back on the editors and said, you know, is there some level of credibility or evidence that people need? I'm not even criticizing this letter, but I'd like to know where they've gone, when maybe they've gone too far, so I can knock on your door, you know, metaphorically, and say, hey, I think you let them cross the line here. I mean, how tenuous does a connection have to be between the center and the Koch brothers and my own, and let alone my own local activities in my community and my job with the center? How much evidence does there really have to be, or how much of a rumor can they spread without your saying, hey, why don't we tone that down a little bit, Mr. and Mrs. Letter Writer? And it, especially because one of the recent letters I wrote for the local papers, there was a thing in the rounding of the numbers that if you rounded it down, it rounded down, and if you looked at the other numbers in the letter, it should look like it would have been rounded up a tenth of a point, so 0.1 versus 0.2. And I got contacted by one of the editors, and just to, your numbers don't look like they add up here. And so I said, this looks like a double standard to me. You're calling me on a rounding issue, and these people are getting to say whatever they want. They can just assert things. And part of the response was, well, you know, we're all busy, I sympathize with that, and we do what we can. We're trying to put out the best product we can in a very tight deadline. And it's a lot easier to check your math than to go validate some kind of vague, broad assertion of secret payments in the background that nobody knows about. And on one hand, that's true, but on the other hand, you're creating this incentive where the person who tries to put forward their information, I mean, that's what I try to do. I get this information together, I construct an argument, and put it out there. And you can agree with it, disagree with it. People disagree with it for reasons I think are dumb, and so I'm not necessarily out there to have a smiley, happy conversation with people, but the idea is that I've put out the data, told you where I got it from, and then told you how I get from there to my conclusion, so that if you disagree, or if you think you disagree, or whatever, then you can look at the data, look at the source, and follow the logic, and point out, hey, your data's wrong, or that source isn't reliable, or your logic doesn't follow from the data. And that way we can have public discourse, you know? That's supposed to be how it works, but if that gets the effect checked, and if editors of these newspapers are inclined toward equivalence between people saying, oh, you shouldn't publish Justin Katz, and my saying, oh, maybe you should have some evidence before you let them publish that. If there's equivalence there, then you're lowering the bar. So the incentive is to not spend hours and hours researching, but to just pass along some rumors and say, hey, that person's a space alien, you know, that one they might call. But incentives matter. And I have a feeling it comes back to that looking at people. There's almost a sense, and I don't want to attribute this to any editors in particular, but there's almost a sense in which the person putting forward the well-constructed argument, me, and at this point, I guess I could say I'm a professional writer, researcher, so I'm a professional at this. It's what I do for a living. You're giving them credibility that you're not giving to the letter writer. And you're saying, the letter writer, that's just some woman writing about local politics. That's like the rumor page. And you two just incidentally happen to mingle on our op-ed and on our opinion pages here. But at that, you need to hold even the people who are just locals, not heavily involved, trying to get involved in a public discussion some way. I mean, you want to draw them in, but you have to hold them to a standard of accountability there. And that doesn't always happen. One thing not at all related, I'm going to jump around a little bit here because I really wanted to point this out. Just another thing, just this morning, we're hearing that the Department of Justice has frozen some of the money for the Rhode Island State Police that they got from Google, their Google investigation. And obviously the big thing that everybody is jumping on is that this money was earmarked to give a no-bid contract to one of Raimondo, or somebody related to one of Raimondo's big donors. So that's the controversy. But I want to jump in here real quick and remind everybody about the Google money. This is money the federal government went out and they found a guy who was in jail for doing online scams, and they had him build up some companies and use Google to do something illegal so they could go after Google for tens of millions of dollars that they distributed to help out their pension systems and all that other stuff. This is wrong. This is wrong, and it should be frozen, but we shouldn't have this incentive. Oh, well, I guess this is the same conversation. We shouldn't have this incentive for government agencies to set up fake companies to entrap international companies in order to get more money, because the international people, and basically all the what it was doing was using ads to help people get around onerous laws that prevent selling prescription drugs over across borders. So the government has set up this structure where forbidding people to do something that they want to do. Google just sets up advertising. They're not. I don't think anybody ever alleged that they were even trying to get something sneaky going and get in on a black market here. So they're just setting up this thing that people can use freely, and the government uses a criminal to entrap the company to get tens of millions of dollars to benefit government agencies. How is that not the giant story here? How is that not everybody left and right saying, whoa, this is just wrong? Whether the money is ultimately going to a no-bid contract to some political crony of the governor's, who cares? I mean, that's like a small story compared to the government setting up laws so that you can break them and then they entrap you to get your money. Come on now. And I do, since it's Holy Week, I did want to throw in one comment on that. A lot of Christians make it a practice this week to watch or listen or otherwise interact with art or media having to do with Jesus Christ's passion, the arrest and leading to the crucifixion and resurrection. And so for some years I watched Mel Gibson's The Passion of Christ. And honestly, after a few years, the effect is wearing off. When it first came out, I think a lot of people had a kind of a whoa moment, because at some point in our comfortable society, you start to see just the cross, the decoration. And you forget what it's supposed to be, the experience that it's supposed to be depicting. And that movie did a lot to, I think, make people say, well, all right, I'm reminded now, thank you, crucifixion, really bad. Other things that people do are, I'll listen to Bach's St. Matthew's Passion of the Christ. I'm not sure that's the official title, but St. Matthew's Passion. Leonard Bernstein's version, so it's in English, so I can follow along. But one thing that's really interesting there, if you want to talk about indicators of culture, when I studied music theory, this piece came up, and what they, at the time, in Bach's time, in the 1600s, they would write Jesus's parts were always really low voices, because that was he was the archetype of man, and men have low voices. And so that would be the part you would have, the baritone or bass, just to have that resonance. And you know it's Jesus because he's got such a deep, manly voice. But then you flash forward, and when I was, a teenage atheist, I'd loved Jesus Christ Superstar. I'm having a mental block on his name. Andrew Lloyd Webber, sorry. and his rock musical is essentially just The Passion, but there are some theological things that people got kind of upset about. But one thing I've never heard anybody mention is that Jesus in that musical has a very high voice. I mean, like a screechy feminine voice. And if you watch the movie version, which is well, let's just say terrible. It's even higher and screechier. So I've always thought that was fascinating, the difference between the 1600s, this kind of muscular Western culture coming back from the Dark Ages, Enlightenment, moving forward. We're entering the era of all this exploration and advancement in technology. Jesus had to have a deep, manly voice. Flash forward to the 70s, you know, having just gone through the 60s, not quite to the 80s yet, and you've got Jesus with a very effeminate kind of presentation. I always thought that was fascinating. Well, anyway, I think it went pretty well with this improvisation thing. Maybe I'll do less work in the future and it'll be fine. Nah, I like the clips. But as always, if you want to let me know what you think, find this post on oceanstatecurrent.com or anywhere you can find my email or even my cell phone, but don't tell anybody, on the site. Just let me know what you think of these things. Leave comments. Any links to material or columns I mentioned will be on that post. And we'll wrap it up with my semi-improvised lyrics added to the blues with which I began. Well, at any rate, have a fabulous Easter, and I'll see you on the other side.
Someday you can't decide what to say. It's like you're stumped, but still your brain is so full of thoughts you need a pump. Don't let your wisdom dry in the cup, you make it up. Don't worry that you'll sound like the fool you know you are. Just open up your mouth and you'll sound just like a song. Don't let your wisdom dry in the cup, you make it up.